listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Start now.
Great.
Okay. Hi, my name is Janann Rauf, and I am here hosting a Freethinkers podcast for Muslimish, and I am with the renowned playwright and writer Heather Raffo. I met Heather Raffo in a very, very interesting way. Nora Mbabi, who's the president of Muslimish, took a workshop with Heather Raffo for Arab Women, I believe. Mm-hmm.
A writing workshop,
mm-hmm. and got very influenced by that. She's out now in India actually doing workshops mm-hmm. as well. It's very inspired mm-hmm. by that. And I became very, very curious because I'm a very naturally curious person. She introduced me to Heather Raffo, and it was very interesting because I took an immediate liking to you as a person. Yeah. I just felt you were very, very warm, and I felt that you had very similar interests to what I had.
I agree.
It was in a very, very, and also I think both of us loved Nora so much that there was a very human connection mm-hmm. immediately that I felt. And she was so kind. This was in Brooklyn when I went to her house, and she let me bring my sons. It was another act of generosity. And then she gave me home, her play, Nine Parts of Desire, to take home with me, and I went home and I read it immediately. And now here I am in Washington, D.C. I just attended Heather's new play, mm-hmm. Nora, which is part of a film festival.
Women's Voices Theater Festival.
Excuse me, a women's theater festival that is, from what I understand, it's an attempt to really amplify and give women who are involved in the theater a place to tell stories that are more from a woman's perspective. And I was looking through some of the plays that were showing. It's also, there seemed to be a lot of women from different demographic groups yep. showing their plays. So I'm here to introduce Heather and talk a little bit about her life and her work. It's very, very exciting, and she's been very generous. After a very intense performance, she's sitting down with me and doing this podcast.
Excited to be here.
So I'm
excited
very,
to
very
be talking
grateful.
To you.
Thank you. So if you tell us a little bit about, you know, your background and who you are. And
yeah, I'm originally from Michigan. My father was born in Iraq, and my mother was born in Michigan. My father came in the 60s when he was in his 30s, got his master's degree, met my mom, and settled in Michigan. So my entire upbringing was in Michigan, but with having family in Iraq. And that was both super exciting as a kid to feel that there was a large part of my family far afield that I'd, you know, get to know. And then it was also quite isolating because at that time, you know, different things started happening in Iraq and we didn't have access to that family. So it was kind of a push-pull between when I would get to feel I had the ability to be with them or not. We went to Iraq in 74. But then I wasn't able to go again until 1993.
So you went in 1974 for a visit?
Yes, when I was 4 years old. And I had aunts and uncles that would come to visit us in the 80s. But as soon as the Iran-Iraq war started, the country was shut down for traveling.
So you couldn't go anymore.
My dad didn't feel comfortable taking us, but it also meant that my young cousins that wanted to come, you know, people that had just graduated high school or early college, they couldn't come out because, you know, they weren't.
It was a war.
There was a war in those age groups. The only person they had let out for visits after the Iran-Iraq war started was my aunt, who had breast cancer, and they let her come for treatment. But even with her, they delayed her visa by quite a lot, and it obviously didn't help her treatment.
How did that impact you as a child? Did you feel cut off?
Yes. So that's why I bring it up, is to say that part of me was utterly fascinated, because I'd been when I was four. Oddly, I remember a lot from being four. But they're the kind of things a four-year-old would remember, as in we would sleep on the roof under the stars, and that's...
So it's very much fun for a
four-year-old. Fun. That's fun. And then there's just all these cousins everywhere, all the time. And
that's,
you know,
fun, too.
And
so
you
the
get
associations
to, right,
are all, like,
fun. And staying up late, and, you know, everybody sitting in a big circle in the garden, and the kids running around till whatever hours, just playing and eating and all the food. And, yeah, so my four-year-old version is that it was fun. And then it
and
was...
And you remembered that, so it had a real
totally
impact.
Remember it. And then the next version was that it's off limits and politicized and at war.
That's starting in the 80s.
Yes. So from my, you know, my older childhood years, I was increasingly aware that I had opportunities that other members in my family didn't have. As in, I wasn't in a war zone.
And
I had the freedom.
So you're talking about your family in Iraq.
Yes.
Yeah. So the sense of privilege that you're safe, that you are.
Exactly.
You have educational opportunities. You're living in Michigan.
Yep. But in every other way, I would say I grew up as an American kid. And what I mean by that is we weren't in a pocket of Middle Eastern people.
Oh, so this
people.
Is not Dearborn, Michigan.
We weren't in Dearborn, no. And we weren't taught Arabic growing up. My dad thought it would cripple us in school, and it wasn't at a time frame where it was cool to be a kindergartner who knew a few languages.
So whereas, he didn't speak to you in Arabic at home?
No. So in every way, I was pushed to be
An
American as I could possibly be. There was a lot of value for what my father's culture and family, for parts of that he carried, but in lots of ways he valued American culture too. So it was totally up to him what we were getting or not getting. I mean, he valued education. So we were always...
Like many Arab fathers.
Right.
That's
exactly.
A really
so we were
important
pushed,
point.
Pushed to get straight A's. If we didn't get straight A's, we weren't
you
doing
and your
our
brother.
Job. Both
so
my
no,
yes, my brother and I. There was no gender
distinction
discrepancy.
There.
If I didn't get a PhD, I was somehow going to be
homeless,
failing the family. Right. The other aspects of the culture were, you know, a huge level of modesty for women. Not so much focus on the arts. I was, you know, always trying to pursue the arts, and that was not something of value to his Middle Eastern mindset.
And I think it's also a lot of immigrants. You know, they want their kids
true.
To be in professions that are lucrative. They
exactly.
want them to make it. I mean, I think, you know, I
yep.
see that in our own community
yep.
a lot. And it's also because a lot of the people who immigrate are themselves professional.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they know.
Yep. And there was also the other value was family. There couldn't be a bigger value than your connection to family and how you treated family and your responsibility to family.
Now, your understanding of family here, you're talking is beyond the nuclear family in Michigan. You're talking about the larger family.
To your brothers, sisters, cousins.
Right.
Yes.
So the extended
yeah,
family.
The extended family.
To whom you didn't have as regular access anymore.
I didn't, yeah. I had access to my extended American family, but not to my extended Iraqi family. But they were very much on our minds because they were obviously... Throughout these different wars, we were concerned for their well-being. My dad was also sending money to keep people afloat during different times. I mean, they were all professionals and very highly educated, but at different moments in particularly the sanctions period after the first Gulf War, you know, so.
The hard times.
Hard times. But I would say that the biggest change for me in my personal identity came in at University of Michigan, where I was studying. It started in university, but it started when the war happened. So the first war with Iraq,
the first Gulf War,
yeah, happened when I was in my 20s. And I think that it's now, I spend a lot of time in universities now as a visiting artist, and I can see that a lot of youth will talk about their first war experience, and it can hit them quite hard depending on what age they are. So if somebody is in their 20s when their first war happens, it can be quite a significant thing versus if they were 8 and not quite...
On your consciousness.
Yeah, on your consciousness. And as an Iraqi American...
How did it hit you?
Well, I mean, it couldn't have been more specific.
Right, because this is...
If I had been even a Middle Eastern American... It wouldn't have been as specific to be Iraqi American at the time that Iraq and America are at war, in the first war of my lifetime. I mean, I wasn't old enough to understand what Vietnam was, right? But this was
your coming of age war.
This is my coming of age war and my loss of innocence too. So,
innocence? Well, how did you describe, like, flesh that out for us? What did that mean?
Innocence meaning. We don't do wars unless they're just.
Okay.
We couldn't possibly get this far without having tried true diplomacy.
Okay. You saw through that.
Of course, but I mean, it more than seeing through it, I was absolutely dumbfounded at how truly little diplomacy was tried.
Right.
I mean,
there was a determination to go to war.
There is cost in blood and money and soil. Like, these wars don't cost nothing, right?
So you didn't feel it was thought through.
It's incredible. Yeah, I didn't, and it was incredible to me to be in my 20s thinking how can we be putting this? How can America be putting this much effort behind this? Without having pursued other options first. There's in many ways it was a loss of innocence. Yeah, and there was also the fear that I would lose my whole family. I mean, they were bombing Baghdad quite relentlessly. And the civilian casualties and collateral damage was, I mean, apparent. So I got really lucky that none of my family actually died in a bombing in that particular war, but lots of other families didn't feel that way. So that was...
Did any of them end up leaving Iraq during that period or after the first war?
So I had a few cousins. So I had about 100 family members in Iraq. My dad had 9 brothers and sisters, and they all had kids, and the kids had kids. So I had a few cousins leave Iraq in the 90s once the sanctions made it apparent that they wouldn't be able to make a living, really, in Iraq.
Because it had become just so difficult.
Yeah, I mean, like, if my cousins was a, you know, lots of them were medical doctors, and a medical doctor's salary went down to $4 a month.
Right.
But a watermelon is $2 and a shirt is $10. So.
And there were no medical supplies, is my understanding.
That too, but we're just talking.
We're just talking basic
salary, that you could be a medical doctor and not be able to feed your family. So you're on a barter system. So a few of my cousins left. Most of them stayed. Most of them stayed through to the second Iraq War. And then round about 2006, 2008, started scattering across the world. I would say each individual person had their own threshold of what was the thing that made them go at that time and why.
What they could take.
And then it wasn't until 2014, when ISIS took Mosul, that I saw the rest of my family leave Iraq.
My family are Catholics.
They are, my dad was born in Mosul and originally from Mosul, but almost all his family had moved to Baghdad.
Okay.
So I had a few cousins living in Mosul, the rest in Baghdad. But when ISIS did take Mosul, the ones that were living in Mosul fled. And
so nobody was captured, thank God.
No, nobody's captured. And all but 2 cousins. I have 2 cousins left in Iraq. So there are
from
2
a family of hundreds.
Of around, yeah, of
and
around 100.
And they're scattered all over the world.
And they're scattered around the world.
Europe, the U.S., Canada.
Europe, Canada, U.S., Europe, and New Zealand, and the Middle East.
So everywhere.
Everywhere but South America and Africa. And Antarctica.
and
right, yeah.
So it was really the fragmentation and the scattering of an entire community that goes back very, very
thousands
back.
Of years.
Thousands of years.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your relationship to Mosul, because it comes up in the play that I saw today.
Yeah, I mean, my relationship to Mosul is both. It's interesting. I was there once in my whole life. I was there when I was 23. And I had made a trip to Iraq on my own after I graduated college. And
so you're
after
fresh
the first
out of college.
Yeah, I was a year out of college. I'd I was living and working throughout Europe and kind of making my way country to country just to have a life experience, and started in England, but country by country got my way to Turkey. Then I said, oh my gosh, Iraq's the next country over, and that's my lifelong dream, and can
what
I
year
go?
Was this?
This was 93.
93, so it was...
It was during the sanctions period. And...
Was it easy for an American to go into?
No, it was it was technically blacklisted, which meant that from an American government point of view, it meant if you went in and had any trouble, nobody was going to help you.
Oh, it's your own responsibility.
You're on your own. And you could be fined.
But it's not illegal.
But they often would turn their eye to people visiting family, because they knew that
they'd make allowance that
yes,
you had family.
But
there.
Generally, you would get your stamp on your passport on a separate piece
there.
Of paper and throw it away, and you'd not been there. But so I went when I was 23 and got to meet all my family as an adult. young adult woman.
So this was after the
first
visit when you were four.
Yeah.
For
this
that
was the
entire
only,
time
I had not been able
back.
To. Right.
Yeah. And what was that like?
I mean, it's one of the most life-changing experiences I've ever had, because I didn't have anybody mediating. I didn't have my dad and mom there. I didn't have my nuclear family to mediate for me.
To translate for you.
Well, to translate, but also to be the reason that I was there. Like, the family realized that I'm there because I want to meet them. Not, it's a family trip. It was some 23-year-old girl.
Who's genuinely curious about.
Has been dying to meet them for their, yeah. So... Right after a war, within 2 years of the war ending.
And
so
you weren't scared at all?
I wasn't scared, because my family wouldn't have let me come if they thought anything was going to happen.
So that gave you a sense of security.
Yeah, so if they had all said, don't come, don't come, don't come, and I went anyway, I mean, that would have been a different story. But because they made whatever phone calls they needed to make to say, is it going to be okay if some... blonde college kid comes traipsing through, right? But yeah, I mean, it was a... I took many things back with me from that trip. I mean, first and foremost was the profound connected love of this family, that here they could not know me or have not seen me since I was a child. And yet... the intricacies of the way family embraces each other there, looks after each other, the way they saw me as one of their own.
Give me some examples of those intricacies, like rituals of accepting you in. And
well, it even surprised me at the border. So you had to cross the border over the desert at that time, because there were no flights into Iraq. It was still the no-fly zone. And I got to from Amman, we drove in a bus, and the bus unloads, and almost everybody off of the bus goes in the lines for Arabs and Iraqis. And I'm like I think I'm the only one that was in the line for other. And they had to, this is for passport, right, control and stuff like that. So they take me through to some back room, and I'm thinking, oh, am I going to get interrogated? Like, what's going to happen? You know, and they show my passport to some guy at a desk, and he gets up and walks the entire room over to me and shakes my hand and says, "Welcome to your father's country."
Oh, wow.
And is holding my hand and looking me in the eye emphatically and says, "You must know our people are not our government. Take back a good impression of the Iraqi people and tell your people about us."
Wow.
And I thought, that's my first experience.
That's very moving.
That's what I get from the first person I'm meeting is, and quite truly, they would call me an Iraqi daughter everywhere I went. If you said your Baba was Iraqi, that was it.
I was one of them.
I was one of them.
So you felt very embraced, like you were just walking into a space that is yours.
Yeah, and people wanted to talk and wanted to share. I was there because I wanted to learn about the culture and learn about the people, but it didn't take much. All I had to do was ask.
What kinds of things did they want you to know? What kind of stories would they tell you?
They didn't want to tell me any bad stories. And I was in hot pursuit of what the war was like for them. And they avoided that a lot until I had to press. So a lot of them wanted to just talk about life. They wanted to learn about my life. They wanted to talk about what they were studying and thinking and feeling.
But they didn't want to talk about the war so much.
It's the Iraqi nature to not want to talk about awful things. To not want to trouble you with them. Mm. So we talked about their pursuits and their dreams and what they felt they could do or couldn't do in their environment. And then I had to press for what was the war like and what really happened from your point of view. And only after pressing and in private would they tell me. But once the floodgate opens for any element of conversation, it's quite open. I mean, I had very, very deep and intimate talks with everyone. I mean,
and in English, so everybody could speak English.
Or somebody could translate.
Or somebody, yeah.
Yeah. But they were as curious about me as I was about them. There wasn't that many foreign visitors anymore.
Mm-hmm. Probably they were happy to have a visitor.
Yeah.
That was affirming in some way
mm-hmm.
to them.
Mm-hmm. They were seen. They were recognized.
How does that impact this visit? How does it impact your work? How does it? Because I know.
Well, I think I realized. I mean, it became really apparent to me on that trip that I was quite Iraqi. You know, if I'd had any doubt growing up, because, I mean, in what way would I need to be Iraqi? I grew up in Michigan and was from Michigan. So it just became deeply apparent to me that the way my soul moved through the world and the things, the way I carried my feelings and carried in the intimacies of my heart was like Iraqi women do. And that just became obvious on that trip. To me and to them. That that I felt things the way they felt them.
So there was an affinity, a sensibility that you
shared. Yeah. It was a time signature to my emotional life that was much more Iraqi than it was American. So even though there are elements of me that are very, very Western, the sort of, I don't know, the only way I could say it is the life of the soul has a time signature that's completely Middle Eastern. And that was news to me because I didn't know what that was. I'd never been in that time signature to know what it was.
So you kind of recognize something about yourself.
Yeah, it's like I found myself. I found the missing part. I mean, it felt, I have to say, another way of describing it is the way orphans feel when they're raised by adoptive parents who are terrific. And they don't have a complaint in the world because their adoptive parents are great. But there's just a little something that's missing. that they go in search of.
It's an affinity.
Yeah. And when they find that birth parent, it makes sense of things.
So it was a very happy trip.
Yeah. So
like.
In no way did I wish I had been raised in Iraq. No way. It wasn't that I was in search of
an identity.
Yeah. Of that, you know, I didn't want to then move to Iraq and be Iraqi. I was happy about my parents and my life. You know, it was all I had was good. It was just, wow, I met this time signature. I met these people that really got the inner workings of me. And I realized that's where I come from.
So it sounds like Iraq kind of gave you access to a deeper dimension of yourself.
Absolutely.
That's what it sounds like to me. And it's, again, I'm going to come back to the original question. How does that play out in your work as an artist, as a playwright, as a performer?
Yeah, so that became my life's work.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So,
take me there.
So prior to going to Iraq, I was pursuing, I had a literature degree, but I was pursuing the theater as an actress.
So that's, this was before your trip. You were already
I'd already gotten a degree. Well, I got my degree in English literature, but with every acting class I could possibly take, and knew I was going to move to New York and become an actor. So that was the trajectory I was on. But after leaving Iraq, it was, how can I integrate this sense of foundness into my art? And I went to grad school, and my grad school experience, getting my MFA in acting, was pretty traditional and in the classics. But for our final thesis, we had to write a solo show. So at that time, I started researching Middle Eastern women in theater, looking for Iraqi female characters, things of that sort, and didn't find any. And I realized there was...
In English.
There was no Iraqi female protagonist in the English language in the theater.
That's quite a...
Yeah. I mean, given we'd had a war with the country.
Two.
Well, two now at this point.
At that point, there was only one.
Yeah, at that point. So, I started writing, and that, the writing that I did my thesis, I did that, but that was the beginning of a play that I would be working on over the next 5 years that took me through 9/11 and the beginnings of the second Iraq War.
And what's the name of that play?
That play is Nine Parts of Desire.
That is my play.
Yeah, so I started writing that in 1998, and it was on stage in 2003, and that grew out of my trip to Iraq in 1993.
How did it grow out of? I mean, tell me a little bit about the process of producing that play, because my understanding is that you did a lot of, you interviewed a lot of women, you talked to a lot of people.
Yep, so Nine Parts directly grew out of the experience of having gone to Iraq, because many of the stories in Nine Parts started in Iraq. Like, it started with the conversations
that
I had had there. Most specifically, there's an artist character who's loosely based on a real person. It's not a fictional account, but that was an artist whose work I saw hanging in what would have been the MoMA of Baghdad, right? And then there's another character loosely based on a woman who lives at the Amriya bomb shelter site, who takes people on tours, who I visited with and went on a tour of the Amriya bomb shelter. So a lot of these stories were completely impacted by experiences I had in Iraq. But further to that, I came back from Iraq full of these stories, therefore in pursuit of more stories. So I was always, because I had this new understanding of what Iraq was, I was talking to more and more people about their experience being Iraqi.
Did you have a particular method of interviewing people, or were these just casual conversations that then went into your writing?
A bit of both, meaning I have a lifetime of very deep conversations that went into the writing.
So conversation is very much a part of your...
Yes. But as you and your audience surely know that you can't just walk up to anyone from the Middle East and start talking to them and get anything intimate. It's hours and hours of tea and eating with people and earning trust and basically being willing to share as deeply from yourself as you want them to share from you.
So it
really required living with people and becoming, you know, the conversations would last days and weeks and months.
So it's complete immersion in the life of people and in the culture.
Immersion or embedded or whatever we would call it, yeah.
Yep. And how would you, what would you say are some of the ways that you build trust?
Well, primarily, as I said, sharing as much of myself as I'm asking them to share. So it's not just me asking a bunch of questions and expecting them to answer. I let them ask a lot of questions, and I give
so kind of a mutual
as frank
as can be
an answer, as vulnerable and as intimate an answer as I'm in search of. So my conversations, particularly with Iraqi women, were about the kind of intimacies, I don't mean sexual intimacies, I just mean personal intimacies that often they wouldn't tell their family. You know, just the...
And they felt safe.
Yeah, they felt safe. I mean, I also had a perfect mix of being Iraqi and American. So I was Iraqi enough to get in the room and be one of them.
And distant enough to be safe.
And distant enough to be safe and be viewed as a non-judgmental. I wasn't carrying the entire gossip of the culture and the... I know all your sisters.
That creates, yeah.
And I'm going to,
And the shame and naive all of that. So these were real relationships. You were really part of a community. This is not just somebody going in.
It's not journalistic.
No.
It's more anthropological. Is that without be the right way of saying it?
It is a little bit anthropological in that you're immersing yourself.
Yeah.
But it's also a little bit more than that. Because, I mean, I think an anthropologist usually would probably be studying a culture or community that he's not necessarily a part of, but you're very much a part of it too.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it is what acting is.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, it's to create a character, you research it from every possible angle, and then you fully immerse yourself in it to the point where you absolutely know what it's like to walk in that character's shoes.
To be that character.
Yeah, you have to go live it, to be it, to play it, to portray it. You have to find as many ways possible to live it.
So did you go back to Iraq, or were you...
I wasn't able to go back to Iraq. So all the subsequent... I mean, I've since gone back to Iraq, but during writing Nine Parts, I was not able to go back to Iraq because the war was on. The second one. I went back in 2012. Or was it 2013? I think maybe it was 2013. That was the last time I was there.
Can you tell us a little bit about the play, what it's about, and where it played? And
yes, Nine Parts of Desire follows the lives of nine different Iraqi women from all strata of society. There's a quite fiercely political communist, there's an artist, there's doctors, wives, mothers.
So all sectors of society.
Yes, a young child. And
loosely based on people you had met and talked to? Or
yes,
just,
or sometimes I would combine people I met into
a story,
yes.
A character.
I say that it's all fiction because I wanted the ability as a writer to go where the play was taking me and not feel every line had to be biographical, but everything the characters say is true and is based in fact and can be researched accordingly. So it definitely feels like a true play to audiences that watch it, and it can even feel, some people have even called it docudrama, which it technically isn't, but it can feel that way. It can feel like it's...
What do you mean by docudrama?
Docudrama.
Explain to the audience.
Docudrama is usually verbatim text done in a journalistic way, so that if you're telling the biographical account of said person, that person has you've recorded everything that person has said,
and it's really what
and
they
it
said.
Is it, it is not changed
verbatim.
Verbatim, what they say. So and
You wanted that more it's freedom researched.
I wanted more freedom because, well, for lots of reasons, but one that a lot of Middle Eastern culture lives through poetry. And the way the rhythms of language and the turn of phrase express themselves. And I wanted the freedom to be a poet and to let these women express themselves.
It is very poetically.
And
I think you have one character who does like lamentation poetry.
Yeah. So it was my freedom to put this in the context of the culture I was writing about while letting the facts remain true.
Right. So you were trying to find that balance between the poetic and what had...
Yeah. And also, I was writing in what I call broken English because I wanted... because I knew the character's point was to be to connect with a Western audience. So I always knew they'd be speaking English and not... There's something about broken English...
You wanted the
Iraqi... That has a rhythm and has a poetry in itself, and I wanted the freedom to... work again in that time signature.
So you're trying to make the Iraqis kind of come through the broken English, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's an obstacle to communicating that often produces an enormously beautiful sound. Right?
And where did the play, where did it show? And what was the audience response? And did you, as an Iraqi American woman, have trouble breaking into the world of theater?
The play has gone all over the world and all over America, and it's had a tremendous response. It's been playing over the last decade. It's played in nearly every major city in America.
Oh, wow.
At all our major regional theater institutions. It ran off Broadway for 9 months, which is quite an extraordinary run for anything to run that long. It was in London and Edinburgh. It's been in many countries.
So you first enacted...
I enacted it at first, and then I
licensed
it. And
it's a one-woman show, right?
I licensed it for others to do, and some people continue to do it as a solo show, and others split it up into three actresses, or sometimes even nine actresses.
And so that's an individual choice, that different theater groups.
Right. But it's as incredible as the commercial run of it has been, now that one can say it has been a big success. It was very, very hard to get it produced at first.
Why do you think?
I think primarily because at the time, which was 2002, 2003, we had just come off 9/11 and we're in a war with Iraq. We were in a war with Afghanistan, followed by a war in Iraq. And nothing like this had ever been on stage before.
Nothing about Iraqi women had ever been on
stage. Nothing about Iraqi women had been on stage, let alone a play about Iraq from an Iraqi viewpoint during the middle of a war. And if you got to remember, like, this is a time where...
Wow.
So people... Where you could only do plays about soldiers. From the soldier or
maybe... From the perspective of an American soldier, you're
saying. Yes, or possibly an American journalist. Those were the only lenses...
Through which we were looking at Iraq.
Through which anybody felt it was safe to look at Iraq.
So this
because otherwise... I mean, this goes beyond, like... It goes beyond just perspective. Like, I understand that we have a perspective here that's a Western lens. But it was deemed unsafe...
To be talking about
the other side's point of view. I mean, what's it, the Dixie Chicks? Like, do you remember the kind of things that would happen when anybody would even say the smallest thing against the war? So if you're a theater and you put on a play that shows Iraqis are humans, you are against the war. And if you're against the war, then you're against the troops.
And it's in a climate of... That's very difficult.
And you can't not support the troops.
So you're coming up against really a kind of tribalism here.
It was impossible for liberal New York theaters...
To put on a play like that.
In a town that was predominantly against the war.
How did you pull it off?
quite a lot of not giving up and finding only one producer willing to take the chance. And he quite bravely took the chance because he said this is the play he'd been looking for. And he wanted it up before the 2004 re-election of Bush. So he had another show in his season that he kicked off in order to get this thing
to fit it through
fast. And once it was up, the reviews were so incredible from all the top newspapers.
What were some of the things that they were saying about
that? Suddenly it was a rave. And once it was this rave, then, like I'm saying, it ran for 9 months, which is unheard of. And then every regional theater that had turned it down wanted it for the next season. So back to this issue of safety. Once one theater could prove it's safe to have a voice like this,
other people got encouraged.
Other people were encouraged. I think also what helped the play, I'll say right now, is that even having rave reviews in like the New Yorker magazine or in the New York Times, it was really a rave review in the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, wow.
That allowed for many theaters across the nation to feel it, they could do the play, because having a conservative paper
write a good deeply review.
But the review wasn't just this a good play. Like, the review went into lots of details of why the play was both challenging but beautiful, and why it was necessary for an American psyche to be in dialogue with a play like this, and put it into the context of the kind of communication we needed to have.
What do you think it was about the play that elicited that kind of a response? What was it?
It was so truthful. And it was so heartfelt. It wasn't agitprop theater. It wasn't agitprop political theater. It was deeply human story driven, personal theater that ended up enlightening the entire experience, the entire history of Iraq, and the entire history of America to it. And what we also must remember at the time is that Americans were hungry for knowledge. I mean, can't tell you how many military families would come to the show hungry because they're like, we just want to know about Iraqis. We want to know about what this war is about.
So there was a kind of dearth of information.
We didn't have the information.
Like subjectively to be in that war. So this play was not making a political statement. It was just
It was making it in a completely soulful, sacred, theatrical way.
So people could see these characters as human beings.
They could take an intense journey of the soul. Yes. See these people as human beings and deeply connect to them across humanity. And quite cathartically come out the other end with a lot of confusion and a lot of compassion.
Now, you talk a lot about how your work is to be a bridge between these two cultures. In what way do you think this play was successful in doing that? And did it generate other kinds of conversations outside the theater?
Yeah. With groups? I mean, people would stay after for an hour just to talk to me. I had men from the Pentagon sobbing in my arms backstage.
Really?
Yeah.
What kinds of things would they tell you?
I had no idea. How can you be at the Pentagon and have no idea? This is so important. I had no idea this was going on.
It was guilt, or it was?
It was witnessing human tragedy.
For the first time?
Yeah. Yeah. In a way that you can if you watch the news. Because you're too deadened.
You brought that to life. Yeah. These are human beings.
Yeah. I can have high school, college students throughout the South saying they never can hear about an Iraqi again without thinking of the play and feeling like they've met the people.
So it makes a real impact on the individual level.
Yeah.
Have you ever done performances in schools or in...
At universities.
At universities you have.
Yeah.
Bring it. And is the response in universities similar?
It's deeply similar. It's because the only people on campus that know Iraq would be servicemen or women.
Or Middle East, or people of Middle East.
Yeah, but I mean, the number of Iraqis you meet on college campuses isn't in record numbers.
Right. But I mean, I think most people from the Middle East would at some level connect.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote another play, mm-hmm. Nora, mm-hmm. which you are currently performing. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about that, the title?
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Nora comes from the name of the female character, who is originally from Mousson and now lives in America. She's been here with her husband and son for about 8 years. And the play deals with different waves of immigration to Iraq, meaning there's three different waves. Their best friend came over during the 90s.
That's after the
first Gulf War. Nora and her husband came in like 2008. And then there's a young refugee fleeing ISIS that came in.
And that's
2017.
Very, very dangerous for Christian Iraqis.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's been pockets of danger and different things happening for different reasons. But the 20-year-old that fled Mosul in the play fled because of ISIS. And they're a family of Christians with a very, very dear friend who's a Muslim, who they're quite close to. It was Nora's neighbor from back home, and they're very close to in their New York lives. And the kinds of conversations they have between them often reflect how much their identities commingled and how they saw each other as part of the fabric of a similar identity.
The Muslim character and the Christian character. The sense of being Iraqi.
Yes, there was
intact.
Yes, was intact and was quite frankly one's first way of identifying. And then,
so first you're an Iraqi and then you're a Christian.
And then you're a, yes.
Or you're a Muslim or you're Sunni or
right.
Shia. And you think the war had a detrimental effect on that?
The war absolutely changed that. That primary identity changed after the American-led invasion in 2003.
So we're talking here two kinds of fracturing. There's the fracturing of the sense of an Iraqi identity, and then there's the fracturing of people becoming scattered.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving in waves mm-hmm. of migration. So there's a tremendous loss of community.
Yes.
That you really feel in the play, which is what you seem to have experienced on your first visit,
mm-hmm.
which was confirmed in your second visit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a recurring concern of yours that I've noticed, you know, from one play to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I would even say was even more deeply confirmed in my third visit. Because when I went in 2012, or 2013, I think it was 2013, sorry, I keep getting it wrong. I wasn't welcomed by anyone in the country as an Iraqi daughter.
That had changed.
Yep.
How were you perceived? How was it different?
American.
And was it a less friendly?
Very unfriendly.
So it had
changed. Nobody wanting to have conversations.
Out of fear, nervousness, or just... Not interested?
Boundaries. There were boundaries.
So it was a much more fluid sense, and people trusted more that you were an Iraqi like them.
In 93, I was a beloved Iraqi daughter that everybody wanted to serve tea to, including strangers on the street, and try to have as deep a conversation as possible. And in 2013, it was just people looking right through you or... looking at you like they're mad.
So there was a loss of, so you're talking about really two levels of loss of community. You're talking about the literal scattering of communities, but even within Iraq, the loss of the sense of being one
mm-hmm.
community, being the daughter of Iraq, that Iraq no longer exists.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were brutalized and under occupation. Why should they be welcome of an outsider?
Absolutely.
They're being flagged. I didn't. It's
makes, no, I know.
Right,
not.
But I mean, it,
no,
I didn't judge it. I just went, wow, what's been, you know,
I'm not
that's one thing
it.
That's been lost. And then the other thing was like,
I'm not judging it.
There's
by
a
the
lot
way.
Of, yeah, no, there's a lot of people that would describe, I mean, when I was researching Nine Parts of Desire, And having all these very intimate conversations with all these different people, I can't, religion came up.
It did.
As
come
in
up.
Faith and God and what they believed or what they thought. I tell you what didn't come up was I'm Sunni or Shia.
So it wasn't a conflict, it was just an exchange of this is what I believe.
They didn't, nobody declared what they were. They were just sharing from their soul.
What faith meant to them.
Yes, and I was told repeatedly by most people that you would never ask your neighbor what they were. It would be impolite.
It would be rude.
Yeah. So to have gone from that being... The case in society to tea barriers and segregated neighborhoods in the mid-2000s, like, forget the minority communities. Forget the Christian and Yazidis and Mandaean. Like,
it's everywhere.
Forget that. I'm talking just the differences between the Sunni and Shia that used to, that had so many intermarried families and so many integrated neighborhoods.
So now there was a self-segregation.
Now there's self-segregation all over Iraq.
And we shouldn't be judgmental given what's happening in our country.
Well, that's where Noura, that's where the play...
Yeah, let's come back
really,
to the play.
...really is hitting Americans because they're seeing... They're seeing this tribalism and polarizing identity taking place for these Iraqis in this play, but directly applying it to what's happening in America and feeling like it's now on our doorstep.
And that no society is immune to this.
No, definitely not. I mean, Iraq, in fact, has had a better track record than America ever had. So Iraq had thousands of years of history living side by side.
Long-established, stable communities.
Yes. I mean,
continuously inhabited.
With divisions that would spike up over the years. But if you count the thousands of years, minority communities and Muslim communities and both Muslim communities have lived in that region.
The continuity.
Both with and without the borders that are currently drawn. Like, they have a real track record. I mean, Iraq basically is the first melting pot.
Right.
Right? They have a track record that far outweighs our 200 years and our, you know, stealing land from the native Indians and enslaving African Americans, or Africans. Like, it's, if we're in a very different
world.
And if we're thinking our problems are going to stay at bay just because we're a democracy, I think we've got to really be a lot more vigilant.
Absolutely. What do you think in, when you went in 1993, what were the things that held the society together, the different groups? What was it, like in your daily life, I'm not talking about ideology, I'm talking about the way people interacted. What were some of the things that kept people civil and talking to each other? And the different communities, the way that they related to each other. What were some of the social mechanisms and rituals and ways of interacting?
Yeah, it's... The pace... People work really hard there. But the pace to which work and social life are balanced is very different. And when I mean social life, I don't mean social life for 15 and 20-year-olds. I mean social life for 15, 20-year-olds and 80-year-olds, like, and everybody in between. Everybody has a social life. So if you're going to, if my 80-year-old uncle spends his day moving across the neighborhood just to buy whatever fruit he's buying across the neighborhood, how many conversations is he having with every neighbor?
At every step of the
at
way.
At every step of the way, and that's his day.
So conversation. So what you're
that
saying
that day
is-
matters to him, and that's his day. And, I mean, I can't tell you how many lunches we had. I mean, dinner is one thing, but, like, lunch.
With other people.
People would come home from the hospital and come home from their engineering jobs and come home from everywhere to have lunch. And neighbors would come over for lunch. And lunch was this big gathering.
So visits and conversation.
Visit and conversation.
Between different groups.
Yes, and then it was, well, we're just, so-and-so makes the best kalecha, so we're just going to her for tea time. And you could just be, like, it was quite funny because I was there as the American. They would use me as the excuse. They're like, you want something sweet, don't you? We'll call Aunt so-and-so for tea. And you could just drop in. It's just like wherever you'd go to drop in to have tea. But the thing is, it wasn't just family. Like, I had a large extended family that was always dropping in on each other for these tea and lunch and snack and dinner and, you know.
So
it was
rituals.
But neighbors would do it, too. And it was just this constant. And sure enough, cousins that have since come here in the last 6-7 years as refugees, but that are working professionals and have found good jobs and are making their way, you know, they'll say that, I said, what's the biggest difference? I ask them what they like and don't
between
like.
Living here.
Yeah, and living there. I ask them what they like and don't like, and they don't ever want to answer that directly. But the biggest difference, they say, is the social life. They're just like, there is no social life here. Like, you have friends. They said, we like our friends. He says, but we don't even have time to go to the gym here.
So like, if you don't, work just eats up your life.
Yeah, you're like, we worked there and we made money and like everybody was a professional that was working, but it just wasn't expected that, like here they said, if you're not working all the time, you're behind. You right. literally fall behind people.
So there's no time. The experience yeah. of time is very, very,
very,
very
different. Your experience of time is entirely different. And even my aunt, who's in her 80s, who's only come here in the last 8 years. So here's an 80-year-old who's uplifted, like never wanted to leave, would have rather died there, but is here now. Like, she just can't bear that she doesn't have a social life. Who do I talk to? Nobody's coming over. Nobody, like she just, the rhythm of her day.
It's a rhythm.
And is completely,
I want to bring that back yeah. to the conversations, because you were talking about when you were in these very deep conversations with people in Iraq that then went into your play, Nine Parts of Desire, that it takes a very long time for people to open up,
mm-hmm.
for people to start having conversations where they actually start to slowly reveal themselves, mm-hmm. to start to tell you things that are actually intimate. So that rhythm has a lot to do with what people can say, are willing to say, or come to a point where they're able to say. And with that loss, it would seem to me, with that loss of time and conversation and the loss of intimacy, that maybe trust then breaks down in a community.
Mm-hmm.
Because you, and it's the constant visiting, the constant reaffirming those social bonds. Like, you know people, but that can also break down. Now here, we don't even have that here, if you think about it. Like, we do really live in bubbles. It's gotten to the point, I think, where, like, one is always talking to people who share similar political views.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any of my neighbors. I don't really talk to them.
Mm. Yeah, but I don't know that. I don't know that that's. I think you're absolutely right in everything you've just said about Middle Eastern culture and Western culture. However, when I go to Michigan, I go to the post office. Like, going to the post office in New York is so painful. It's so painful because it's always a long line. Everybody's grumpy. It's, you know, nobody wants to sit and chit-chat. You go to the post office in Michigan, they want to chat. They want to ask about...
Well, time is slower a little bit, too.
How's this and how's that? And, I mean, if I go on a walk around my parents' cul-de-sac, everybody has to wave at me.
Right.
Every car that drives by is waving. They don't even know me. Like, they might remember my face from last summer because I go every summer, right? But, like, it's
No, of course, there are regional differences.
There are regional... I mean, and New York also has something that's, you know, we might not know our neighbors in some ways, but on the other hand, we're all on the subway together. We're all packed in
right.
and relating to each other,
I was talking about the New Jersey suburbs.
Even if we're not right. talking, but you
yeah.
know what I mean. Like, there's, but I think what you're right about is the overall energy in America is isolated, even though we have these really amazing communities, and that's something I'm trying to wrap my head around, because we have communities that are quite connected. But
give me some examples.
What I mean is my Michigan community, Michigan as a community that I go back and touch base with, is very connected. I don't live there. My parents are aging and live in a cul-de-sac in a suburb of the capital city that's not even a big city, right? It's a, you know, suburbs. And yet everybody around there will talk to you. But here's what I know. I walk in as a white woman with two white kids. You see what I mean?
Right.
Into what is a pretty much white with some diversity community. My point is, they're so, I don't even live there. I haven't lived there for longer than I lived there. I haven't lived there for over 22 years. And I go maybe once a year for a few weeks.
But you feel very much at home when you go there.
Well, no. I mean, it doesn't matter if I feel at home or don't. My point is, they treat me like I'm
at home.
Like I could be from there. They treat me like I could be from there. Hi, hi, what's going up with your kids? How's the, oh, you need that kind of thing to, okay. You know, just constant chitter chats, constant doors open, constant, right? My point is, it's a community. It really is. People look out for each other. My dad has Alzheimer's and drove and got himself really lost in the next farm community over, ended up at a high school up on the curb. Didn't hurt anybody. The policeman from the school, or not the policeman, security guard from the school and school officials sat with him. My mom came, but the way they sit with you, oh my God.
They took care of
him.
Oh my God. They looked out for him.
For hours. I mean, just, how is he going to be okay? You know, what's up with, then we go to get the car fixed. My dad was trying to go get the car fixed. He had three conversations with the guy. Finally, I go back and I'm like, my dad, memory, he's got dementia. And the guy was the sweetest, like, I know, it's okay. And then basically spent 30 minutes telling me the same thing he'd probably told my dad three times. Like, he's like, yeah, somebody in my family, what he said, his grandpa has, like.
So there's an incredible tolerance on looking out for people who are aging.
I mean, it's, nobody, who would do that in New York? Like, we don't have time. Like, the it's way, not- like, my dad's looked after, now my dad's a, us. An adorable Middle Eastern man with a thick accent.
And yet people will take care of him.
But people took care of him. Now, would it... But here's what I know for a fact. If I walked in with very dark skin, my experience of this community might be very different. It may or may not. I don't know.
In your play, Nora, there's a real...
But that's what I'm saying. It's like, we've got communities... Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, we've got communities, but we're isolated. This is the point. We look after our own. We look after people we think we're comfortable around in America.
Because we are pretty segregated.
We're segregated and we're tribal. And that's what I think is the problem. We can't say we don't have a sense of community in this country. We do. But it's not very generous.
Some of us do.
It can often be very ungenerous, and that's...
What do you mean by ungenerous?
Ungenerous is... If we sense that we're afraid of that person because they're too other, we're not going to help.
But when we also, sense we that also that have person, media that is constantly scaring us.
It totally is.
For years, we've been demonizing.
And then there's
people.
Other ways that we always want to help all the time. I mean, look at every hurricane and what we do.
Right.
People are on their high horse and their boats off saving lives, saving every dog's life. Like, I mean...
Because they're not feeling threatened at that
particular moment. Right, at that particular moment. So we've...
But we do have... So much of your work is about community, and what do you envision as ways for us to form communities in this really difficult moment
yes.
in American history to kind of overcome the kinds of divisions, the isolation, and the fear mm-hmm. that we have? How mm-hmm. do you see that? 'Cause I know that that has played a really important part in your most recent play, Nora, and she's really trying to hold things together. Mm-hmm. But then she ultimately ends up...
Unable to.
And, you know, if we're looking in the future, what kind of communities do we need to form? Or even possible?
I don't know that I have an answer for that. I can definitely say I'm in search of an answer for that. I definitely am leaning... at the moment toward grassroots politics and community-driven programs. Because I think, even compared to Middle Eastern culture, American culture has some of the most generous individuals. They Americans, if you can appeal to their hearts, can be the most generous people on the planet. So they can be appealed to. We have that potential. I also think even the best of us lead super busy, quite stressful lives where we don't all have the ability to look out for everyone.
And super busy means you can be less generous with time.
Yes.
Time is a form of generosity,
yes,
too.
So maybe what will become true in me if I keep talking is that I lean more socialist than I do capitalist. Like, I want there to be institutions in place that genuinely look after people. That genuinely look after people so that all of us aren't worried all the time that every human is falling through the cracks.
Or and that fear is what divides us, because...
Or that only the 1% are actually making it. So I want grassroots community policy. I want local politics to enact things that people genuinely need. And I think it's back to, like...
So what you're saying is when you have those kinds of institutions where you take care of people, they're less anxious, that there's more time for sociability and for communal life.
Yeah. I mean, we all have time to donate here or there, but we can't have
There's
10 causes. We have one or two, right?
Because we have human limitations.
Because we have human limitations, right. And I also think that we are really torn in America right now between our better selves that are quite community-driven and know the power of it, and our rugged individualistic nature as Americans, that we know success is a vertical path from which you work all hours of the day and sometimes don't even contribute to your own family, right? So I think that in every way we're trying to find the right balance. At this moment, we clearly haven't.
It's
at
really
this
hard.
Moment, there are a lot of people that both aren't succeeding and are falling through the cracks.
And this is something that comes out in the play really beautifully, is that you have a character who's starting to establish himself from Iraq, who's finally starting to get a little bit of stability, wants to enjoy the safety, and then his wife, Nora, who's trying to hold...
The past together.
And then I was thinking to myself, this is not just a dilemma for refugees. This is for all of us. Mm-hmm. It speaks to everyone.
Yeah. There's some of us that are inordinately attached to history and past and carrying those kind of truths around all the time and making sense of them. And then there's the other half of us that just wants to be in the present and get on with it.
And these people are not, it's not just a matter of being interested in the past and history, but I think also people who are just concerned about our collective fate.
Yes.
People who are really concerned about what's happening with the environment, people who are very concerned about what's happening with income inequality and the way in which it interacts with environmental issues. And so the idea is, I think many of us are suffering and craving because of these structural inequalities and because...
Well, because government has also been failing.
Exactly, but you need institutional support for communities, is the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why there's so much... I mean, for Nora, it's almost like she has to have superhuman energy and determination to keep the family going. Mm-hmm. Everything, because there's very little helping individuals. You know, she's coming out of a country that is literally...
Yeah, there's a character in the play that says this country makes you forget. It makes you move on.
Yeah. I think the play is really well worth seeing. I recommend that everybody who has a chance to go see it. It'll be opening up in New York at the Playwrights Horizons.
Playwrights Horizons, November and December of 2018.
Very exciting. Thank you so much. That was really, really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.